Greetings and welcome to the program. I hope your week has been fruitful and happy and your heart has stayed warm. We're going through the text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun by Nam Kar Pel, which are translated in English as sometimes quite obscure slogans. Take the one we started with last week. Every yoga should be performed as one. Without explanation, who knows what this means? But we saw last week that if we are mind training practitioners, it indicates that everything we do has to be performed as a mind training exercise. From the commentaries we visited, that meant to Alan Wallace that we should apply the Dharma teachings to all our activities, including the most mundane daily ones, to cultivate ultimate and relative bodhicitta. Bhima Chodron took that a step further and said that awakening the heart had to do with learning how to communicate properly. Others, like Trungpa Rinpoche and Judy Leaf, translate the slogan as, all activities should be done with one intention. And so we'll have a look at those commentaries as well. But now, before anything else, let's set a bodhicitta motivation for the program as usual. I have often spoken of the importance of this type of motivation, and it fits perfectly with the exhortation to do everything with the same intention. If you were with us at the end of last week's program, you may remember we quoted from Lama Zopa Rinpoche with this. If our mind is rich in compassion and loving kindness, if our heart is filled with compassion towards other sentient beings, then even if all people and animals are angry and harm us, from our side, we see them as our friend or relative. If our mind has compassion, then all sentient beings are our friends, and we feel that everyone is close to our heart. Therefore, we can see that the good heart, loving kindness and compassion, and bodhicitta are incredibly precious, and we can see how unbelievably important it is to practice them. In our life, in every hour, we need to pay attention and always put every single effort into having a good heart. With this good heart, we see all the other sentient beings' harm as benefiting and purifying us and finishing our own negative karma. We see so many ways that sentient beings' harming actually benefits us. If we think carefully and examine this well, we understand that transforming our own mind into the good heart, the loving, compassionate thought of bodhicitta, is the source of all happiness. So now, let's take a moment to check if we have this motivation, and if not, to try to develop it. Thank you. Now let's have a look at Trungpa Rinpoche's commentary on his translation, All Activities Should Be Done With One Intention. He says, practice here includes the training of meditation in the post-meditation state, how to practice while eating, while walking, while sitting, while lying down, while talking to others, and so forth. In other words, whatever activities we do, there's one way to focus, one way to practice. In this particular context of mind training, that is, training our attitude of bodhicitta, it means being benevolent, and this implies never parting from the goodwill of wanting to benefit others in all that we do, whether we are able to bring all living beings into our focus or only a few. This is the first guideline. All practice should be done with one intention. Judy Leaf, in her commentary, says essentially the same thing, but takes the analysis a little deeper. She writes on www.tricycle.org, it seems that every day we've fallen willy-nilly into a never-ending string of activities. They seem to come at us from outside without having anything to do about it. We keep busy with one thing after another from morning until night. At times we may be really organized and lay out plans day by day and week by week. We have goals and deadlines. At other times, it may be more as if we are responding to requests that come up without any clear pattern or direction. Emails, meetings, obligations keep flooding in, and we find all the little squares in our calendars filling up. Now, what holds all this activity together? Is there any thread that runs through all this business? Or are we just trying to make it through another day? What do you know about your underlying intention? Without saying it in so many words, often the thread holding all our thoughts and activities together is, what's in it for me? We wonder how we can survive, get ahead, win, succeed, overcome, take over, grab something, be recognized, appreciated, rewarded. You name it, the list is endless. In mind training practice, the idea is to replace that unspoken intention based on fear and the need to prop up the ego with an intention of benevolence. Rather than making a few heroic or virtuous gestures or taking on some righteous cause, the idea is to have a quality of awareness, gentleness, and benefit to others color everything we do. Such an intention should color even the way in which you do the simplest things, like picking up your teacup. Your gestures, speech, thoughts, and emotions should all be expressions of one intention, the powerful intention of benefiting sentient beings. That's Judy Leaf. Now, I may not be a Buddhist, but Lee Elliott, in an article on www.theindependent.com, covers not only how a benevolent attitude helps others, but has an effect on ourselves as well. The article is titled Benevolence, the Key to Great Riches, and it opens with, "Kindness is a strength of character," and then continues, "As such, being kind to others increases our happiness." In itself, that is a fairly compelling reason to be kind, but there's so much more. As we begin to form relationships with others, one of the first things they will consider is the extent to which they believe we can be trusted. Trustworthiness comes about whenever we are able to do what we say we can do, when we consistently act with integrity, and we are benevolent. Of these, lack of integrity damages trustworthiness. Benevolence grows trustworthiness. Benevolence is a very special category of kindness. It is a kindness without any expectation of anything in return. That is, it is a kindness without strings. The more often we are benevolent to others, the more often they see we can be trusted, and the more they will like us and think of us as friends. Now here's a second benefit of benevolence. Friends are another source of happiness. This is especially true as we get older. It may be that the families in our country are so busy and just don't have much time for elderly family members. Whatever the cause, as we age, it appears friends become more important to us. How many of you thought, like I did, that friends are most important to teens? If you think about it a bit, the blight of growing old is loneliness. Younger family members are busy with all the obligations they have to meet. Who is most available to give us comfort and support? Well, our friends will do that, of course. The impact of benevolence on relationships is clear. When I've worked with someone who's struggling with relationships with others, one of the first things I've done is to encourage them to begin to focus on benevolence. After a long talk about benevolence, what it means and how they might be benevolent with others, they go off to be kind. And it works. I've suggested this to many people, and I've yet have it not work. The relationships improve. In fact, in many cases, employees who were struggling with stress, frustration, and so on were asked to assume responsibility for joy in their area of employment. As they put more and more effort into fulfilling their new responsibility, they found their own happiness increasing, relationships improving, and their superiors substantially changing their perception of them. We then ask them to focus on the invisible people, those people they work with, but no one noticed. In most cases, the impact was certainly gratifying. Not only did the person who previously was struggling become benevolent to those people, the invisible people began to respond with sincere gratitude, since it was so uncommon that anyone ever noticed they were even there. The result was a spiral that left all in a much better place. The value of benevolence is that just the act of benevolence increases our happiness. It increases the number and strength of our friendships. Friendships further increase our happiness, and it can bring the people who aren't seen out of the shadows. Those who are benevolent often are well-liked. There's one more benefit of benevolence. Benjamin Franklin found he liked people more if he did a favor for them. As such, not only does benevolence improve others' perceptions of us, we like them more too. Like I said, benevolence is a key to great riches. That's Lee Elliott. And so the more benevolence we have towards others, the more we help ourselves and improve our environment. Everyone and everything benefits. Even if you're not much concerned with enlightenment and liberation, benevolence will make this life so much more happy for you. Now, returning to mind training like the rays of the sun, in his commentary, the great Buddhist scholar Dr. Alex Berzin encourages us to develop benevolence even for the bugs living in our guts. In his commentary, the slogan is, "Do all yogas with one." And he writes, "Whatever we do, we should do it in order to be able to help others." An example often used in India, where people frequently have worms, is the inspiration, "When I eat, may I nourish all of the microorganisms in my body." Now, even if we can't sustain this type of motivation throughout the meal, we can start off like that. The dedication verse written by Nagarjuna, "I take this food not out of attachment and greed, but as a medicine to help others," is very helpful. And that leads to the thorny question of meat eating. Now, of course, if you have great benevolence for all creatures, it seems impossible that you would eat the meat off the bones of any creature. However, as far as Buddhism is concerned, the teachings of different traditions vary. It is, for instance, permissible for monks to eat meat if it has not come from an animal that was slaughtered specifically for them. But His Holiness the Dalai Lama does not encourage anyone to eat meat, least of all the monks. On his instruction, many Tibetan monasteries no longer allow their monks to eat meat at the monastery. And if you know how much Tibetans are familiar with eating meat, you will know what a great turnaround this is. Here is what His Holiness says on not showing benevolence to other beings. He was asked, "Is it permissible for Buddhists to eat meat?" And this was his answer. And you can find it on www.elephantjournal.com. "Some Buddhist texts say that it is not permissible to eat any meat, but others, including the Abhidharma Kosha, said it's permissible to eat meat on the condition that the animal was not slaughtered specifically for the person who eats it. The best thing is to give up meat entirely. Sometimes one's lifestyle and circumstances provide no alternative but to eat meat, and in these cases, one should eat as little meat as possible. Tibetan monasteries and nunneries in South India have become entirely vegetarian 15 years ago. Festivals and ceremonies in all Tibetan monasteries and nunneries should be completely vegetarian. When I was in Tibet, aged 13 or 14, my government officially banned meat from religious festivals and ceremonies. The abuse we inflict on hens has always been particularly disturbing to me, and I've always been particularly concerned towards how these animals are treated in industrial food production. I am troubled to learn about the practice of confining egg-laying hens in tiny cages. In these cages, birds cannot engage in their natural behaviors, such as spreading their wings, laying eggs in a nesting area, perching, scratching at the ground, even standing on a solid surface. Each hen has less space to live than the very sheet of paper I have written this letter on. Turning these defenseless animals into egg-producing machines, with no consideration for their welfare whatsoever, is a degradation of our own humanity. Switching to cage-free eggs would reduce the suffering of these animals." Ajahn Brahm, the famous abbot of the Theravadin Bodhayana Monastery in Perth, speaks further about what the Buddha allowed in an article titled "What the Buddha Said About Meat Eating" on www.urbandharma.org. And this is what he writes. "Since the very beginning of Buddhism over 2,500 years ago, Buddhist monks and nuns have depended on alms food. They were, and still are, prohibited from growing their own food, storing their own provisions, or cooking their own meals. Instead, every morning, they would make their day's meal out of whatever was freely given to them by lay supporters. Whether it was rich food or coarse, delicious or awful tasting, it was to be accepted with gratitude and eaten regarding it as medicine. The Buddha laid down several rules forbidding monks from asking for the food that they liked. As a result, they would receive just the sort of meals that ordinary people ate, and that was often meat. Once, a rich and influential general by the name of Siha, meaning lion, went to visit the Buddha. Siha had become a famous lay supporter of the Jain monks, but he was so impressed and inspired by the teachings he heard from the Buddha that he took refuge in the Triple Gem. That is, he became a Buddhist. General Siha then invited the Buddha, together with a large number of monks accompanying him, to a meal at his house in the city the following morning. In preparation for the meal, Siha told one of his servants to buy some meat from the market for the feast. When the Jain monks heard of their erstwhile patron's conversion to Buddhism and the meal that he was preparing for the Buddha and the monks, they were somewhat peeved. Then Ajahn Brahm quotes from the Book of Discipline, "Now at the time, many Nigantas, that's Jain monks, waving their arms, were moaning from carriage road to carriage road, from crossroad to crossroad in the city. Today a fat beast, killed by Siha the general, is made into a meal for the recluse Gautama the Buddha. The recluse Gautama makes use of this meat, knowing that it was killed on purpose for him, that the deed was done for his sake." Ajahn Brahm says, "Siha was making the ethical distinction between buying meat already prepared for sale and ordering a certain animal to be killed, a distinction which is not obvious to many Westerners, but which recurs throughout the Buddha's own teachings." Then, to clarify the position on meat eating to the monks, the Buddha said, "Monks, I allow you fish and meat that are quite pure in three respects, if they are not seen, heard, or suspected to have been killed on purpose for a monk. But you should not knowingly make use of meat killed on purpose for you." And those words are also from the Book of Discipline. Ajahn Brahm continues, "There are many places in the Buddhist scriptures which tell of the Buddha and his monks being offered meat and eating it. One of the most interesting of these passages occurs in the introductory story to a totally unrelated rule, and the observation that the meat is purely incidental to the main theme of the story emphasizes the authenticity of the passage. Upalavana, meaning she of the lotus-like complexion, was one of the two chief female disciples of the Buddha. She was ordained as a nun while still a young woman and soon became fully enlightened. As well as being an arahant, she also possessed various psychic powers to the extent that the Buddha declared her to be foremost among all the women in this field. Once, while Upalavana was meditating alone in the afternoon in the Blind Men's Grove, a secluded forest outside of the city of Savati, some thieves passed by. The thieves had just stolen a cow, butchered it, and were escaping with the meat. Seeing the composed and serene nun, the chief of the thieves quickly put some of the meat in a leaf bag and left it for her. Upalavana picked up the meat and resolved to give it to the Buddha. Early next morning, having had the meat prepared, she rose into the air and flew to where the Buddha was staying, in the bamboo grove outside of Rajagahaya, over 200 kilometers as the crow, or nun, flies. Though there's no specific mention of the Buddha actually consuming this meat, obviously a nun of such high attainments would certainly have known what the Buddha ate. However, there are some meats which are specifically prohibited for monks to eat. Human meat, for obvious reasons, meat from elephants and horses, as these were then considered royal animals, dog meat, as this was considered by ordinary people to be disgusting, and meat from snakes, lions, tigers, panthers, bears, and hyenas, because one who had just eaten the flesh of such dangerous jungle animals was thought to give forth such a smell as to draw forth revenge from the same species. Towards the end of the Buddha's life, his cousin Devadatta attempted to usurp the leadership of the order of monks. In order to win support from other monks, Devadatta tried to be more strict than the Buddha and show him up as indulgent. Devadatta proposed to the Buddha that all the monks should henceforth be vegetarians. The Buddha refused and repeated once again the regulation that he had established years before, that monks and nuns may eat fish or meat as long as it is not from an animal whose meat is specifically forbidden, and as long as they had no reason to believe that the animal was slaughtered specifically for them. Ajahn Brahm then continues, "The Vinaya then is quite clear on this matter. Monks and nuns may eat meat. Even the Buddha ate meat. Unfortunately, meat eating is often seen by Westerners as an indulgence on the part of the monks. Nothing could be further from the truth. I was a strict vegetarian for 3 years before I became a monk. In my first years as a monk in northeastern Thailand, when I bravely faced many a meal of sticky rice and boiled frog, the whole body, bones and all, or rubbery snails, red ant curry or fried grasshoppers, I would have given anything to be a vegetarian again. On my first Christmas in northeastern Thailand, an American came to visit the monastery a week or so before the 25th. It seemed too good to be true. He had a turkey farm, and yes, he quickly understood how we lived and promised us a turkey for Christmas. He said that he would choose a nice fat one, especially for us, and my heart sank. We cannot accept meat knowing it was killed especially for monks. We refused his offer. So I had to settle for part of the village's meal. Frogs again. Monks may not exercise choice when it comes to food, and that is much harder than being a vegetarian. Nonetheless, we may encourage vegetarianism, and if our lay supporters brought only vegetarian food and no meat, well, monks may not complain either. May you take the hint and be kind to animals. And then for another point of view, here is Matthieu Ricard, who you may remember we quoted last week. A monk in the Tibetan tradition, he's known as the happiest man in the world and has written a book titled A Plea for Animals. On www.lionsroar.com, he speaks about what makes him sad about our use or our overuse or abuse of animals. His article has the same title as his book, and in it he writes, "Some people are born with a natural tendency to be compassionate. From an early age, they show spontaneous kindness towards those around them, including animals. This was not the case for me. I was born into a Breton family, and until 14 years old, I often used to go fishing. I also remember when I was very young, my friends from the local school and I once grilled ants by focusing the sun's rays on them with a magnifying glass. Looking back, I'm ashamed of this, but it upsets me even more that such behavior struck me as normal. When I was 5, my father took me to see bullfights in Mexico. It was a celebration. The music was exciting. Everybody seemed to feel this was a great occasion, that all of this was wonderful. Why didn't I leave in tears? Was it a lack of compassion, of education, of imagination? At the age of 20, I had the great good fortune of meeting Tibetan spiritual masters, who from that time on have inspired every moment of my existence. The central point of their teachings has been the royal way of love and universal compassion. Although for a long time I had not been able to put myself in others' places, by training with the masters, I learned altruistic love, doing the best I could to open my mind and heart to the plights of others. I trained myself in compassion, and I reflected on the human condition and the condition of animals as well. It is far from my intention to rebuke people who in one way or another cause animals to suffer. They often do it without thinking, as I myself used to do. It is truly difficult to make the connection between the latest consumer items, including food and medicines that sometimes save our lives, and the suffering that is usually involved in their fabrication. Cultural traditions also play a major role in our perceptions of animals, our companions on this planet. Some societies have developed collective patterns of thought that encourage the view that animals exist to serve humans, although the outlook of other traditions has long been that every being, human or non-human, must be respected. Certainly, there is so much suffering among human beings that one could spend one's whole life just alleviating a tiny fraction of it. Despite that, however, concern for the fate of the 7.7 million other species of animals that inhabit this planet is neither unrealistic nor misguided, because most of the time there is no need to choose between the well-being of humans and the well-being of animals. We live in an essentially interdependent world, where the fate of each being, of whatever kind, is intimately linked to that of all the others. So what I'm suggesting here is not concern for animals only, but concern for animals also. Such an approach does not involve humanizing animals or animalizing humans. Rather, it is a matter of extending benevolence and kindness to all. Reaching out in this way is more about taking a responsible attitude towards all that is around us than about making choices concerning what we should do with the limited resources we possess for action in the world. In spite of the sense of wonder the animal kingdom inspires in us, we are responsible for an ongoing massacre of animals on a scale unequaled in the history of humankind. Every year, 60 billion land animals and 1,000 billion marine animals are killed for our consumption. Moreover, this mass killing and its corollary, the excessive consumption of meat in the wealthy countries, is madness on a global scale. It perpetuates hunger in the world, increases the world's ecological imbalances, and is even harmful to human health. We continue to live in ignorance concerning the harm we inflict on animals. Very few of us have ever visited an industrial breeding site or a slaughterhouse. We maintain a kind of moral schizophrenia that has us lavishly pampering our pets and at the same time planting our forks in the pigs that have been sent to the slaughter by the millions, even though they are in no way less conscious, less sensitive to pain, or less intelligent than our cats and dogs. Starting with the era of the ancestors we share with the other animal species, little by little, by a long series of steps and minimal changes, we arrived at the stage of Homo sapiens. In the course of this slow evolution, there was no magical moment that would justify our conferring on ourselves a special nature that makes us fundamentally different from the many species of hominids that preceded us. Nothing occurred in the evolutionary process that would justify our claim to a right of total supremacy over animals. The most striking quality that humans and animals have in common is the capacity to experience suffering. Why do we still blind ourselves, now at the beginning of the 21st century, to the immeasurable suffering that we inflict on animals, knowing that a great part of the pain that we cause them is neither necessary nor unavoidable? Certainly, we should know that there's no moral justification for inflicting needless pain and death on any being. That is Matthieu Ricard, and let his words be our meditation for the coming week. Now our time is up. Thanks for being with the program today, and I hope you'll tune in again next week. Please don't forget to dedicate all the positive potential we've accumulated in the program to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Thank you, and goodbye.